Og så skal vi for sidste gang besøge tennisklubben Wimbledon. I vores lille miniserie om en af sportsverdens helt store begivenheder, er vi nu nået frem til en af dem, der har hånden på roret. Hvordan er turneringen organiseret? Hvem bestemmer, hvor mange penge klubben tjener? Hvordan får man billetter? Kan Wimbledon arrangeres mere bæredygtigt? Alle de spørgsmål, samt en hel del om græs, forsøger klubbens talsmand at svare på og forklare om i dette femte og afsluttende afsnit.
Wimbledon er nu for længst forbi. Det store tenniscirkus har bevæget sig over Atlanten. Spillerne og mine nye venner fra CBS og Altacirrus Sport er netop nu i gang med tennissæsonens sidste store turnering, US Open i New York. I Wimbledon går livet imidlertid videre. Klubbens medlemmer mødes og spiller tennis og drikker te, dog ikke på center court og court number one. Her bliver græsset og de øverste 6 cm jordlag barberet af, kort efter at vi journalister er taget hjem, og klubbens stab af højt betalte gartnere er nu i gang med at anlægge underlaget til næste års turnering. Det med græsset er en helt videnskab og noget, klubben går meget op i. Det er ikke bare at rulle nogle græsmåtter ud eller smide nogle frø på noget kunstgødet jord. For at få det helt perfekte og robuste græsunderlag er der investeret rigtig mange ressourcer. For os, der ikke ved så meget om tennis, at det gør noget, er det med græsset vel næppe noget, mange tænker over. Men det forholder sig sådan, at efterhånden kun er Wimbledon blandt de store turneringer, der har holdt fast i spillets oprindelige underlag. Alle andre er gået over til at spille på underlag, der er nemmere at vedligeholde og ikke kræver så meget opsyn. Faktisk var det sådan i en længere årrække, at det synes uundgåeligt, at også Wimbledon før eller siden måtte bøje sig og foretage det pragmatiske valg. Ikke så meget på grund af, hvad det kostede klubben at have græsbaner, men mere på grund af, at der ikke længere fandtes andre klubber eller turneringer, hvor spillerne kunne øve sig og vende sig til underlaget, inden de skulle spille i Wimbledon. Måske kan I huske, at årets kvindelige vinder, rumæneren Simona Halep, fortalte, hvor specielt det var at vinde på et underlag, som slet ikke fandtes i hendes hjemland. Græs er et meget anderledes underlag at spille på end grus og de forskellige typer for plastik, der er udbredt, så hvis spillerne ikke havde mulighed for at lære underlaget at kende, før de kom til Wimbledon, kunne man slet ikke have en seriøs tennisturnering, lød argumentet indtil for ikke så lang tid siden. Men Wimbledon valgte i stedet at gå mere offensivt til værks og finansielt understøtte de få turneringer, der stadig spillede på græs, og selv oprette et par opvarmningsturneringer. Det betyder, ifølge talsmanden, som I skal høre lige om lidt, at klubben i dag føler, at de har sikret græsset en fremtid i tennisens tjeneste. Personligt synes jeg, at næsten hvert af de 120 minutter båndet interview med Wimbledons talsmand Johnny Perkins, jeg har til rådighed til dette sidste afsnit om klubben og turneringen, er interessante. Og havde jeg fornemmelsen af, kunne have varet dobbelt så lang tid, havde jeg ikke måtte afbryde vores snak for at nå over at se semifinalen mellem Novak Djokovic og Roberto Bautista Agut. Vi, talsmand og jeg, havde en virkelig god kemi, og det var nemt at spørge ham om de mere, måske lidt kontroversielle ting, som pengenes magt, hvordan den massive markedsføring låner de kulturelle koder, vi talte om i sidste afsnit, ja, hele det der begreb, the narrative, som en kommerciel identitetsmaskine, overklassekulturen med champagne og jordbær, og hvorfor Wimbledon ikke markerede priden. Lidt på afstand af vores snak kan alligevel godt blive lidt i tvivl om, hvorvidt kemien mellem den anden radios tenniskorrespondent og Wimbledons talsmand virkelig var helt så naturlig, som jeg oplevede den. Man gør i hvert fald klogt i at erindre, at de dygtigste, mest professionelle talsmænd, og det gælder vel uanset, hvad de er talsmænd for, ja, de er i stand til at skabe et særligt rum i det øjeblik, man interviewer dem, hvor de synes at være bevidste om lige præcis hvilke ord, hvilken grad af formalitet eller åbenhed, som vil passe til et givet publikum. Og Johnny Perkins har været ansat i sin stilling i 24 år, så han kan selvfølgelig til kram. Men det er vel mest en personlig refleksion. For lytterne er det jo egentlig ligegyldigt. De kan blot, som jeg selv gjorde i situationen, nyde hans venlige, åbenhjertige og tilgængelige facon. Det var i øvrigt det eneste interview, jeg fik lov til at lave uden opsyn fra min normale vagt. Under alle omstændigheder belyser vores samtale direkte eller indirekte mange af de aspekter, betragtninger og betydningslag, som hele denne miniserie om Wimbledon har kredset om, og mere til. Desto mere interessant er indholdet, fordi at jeg på dette tidspunkt af mit ophold var blevet lidt mere klar over, hvordan systemerne fungerede, hvor i hierarkiet de mange forskellige mennesker, jeg havde mødt, placerede sig, Lidt ligesom, det kan lytteren sikkert godt sætte sig ind i, hvordan man oplever en ny arbejdsplads første dag og så 14 dage senere. Vi begynder med at lade talsmanden introducere sig selv og fortælle lidt om sit arbejde som forbindelsesled mellem klubben og den omkringliggende bydel. Et arbejde, der involverer mange møder med politikere, byplanlæggere, entreprenører og så selvfølgelig naboerne. Han fortæller, at Wimbledon Tennis Club på et hvert givet tidspunkt af året har ca. 40 byggesager i gang, og det kræver selv sagt en hel del forhandling og også en fingerspids fornemmelse af, hvad man kan tillade sig uden at blive en dårlig nabo. Vores samtale fortsætter med at tale om det nylige opkøb af golfklubben på den anden side af vejen. En så massiv forandring af Wimbledons fysiske størrelse kommer selv sagt også til at betyde noget for magtbalancen mellem klubben og dens naboer, og dermed bliver også Johnny Perkins arbejdsliv redefineret. Han kommer i de næste årrække til at have rigtig mange aftenmøder. Det er på den tid af døgnet, at grundejere og naboforeninger helst vil mødes, og bekymringerne om, hvad tennisklubben kan finde på, er allerede begyndt at melde sig. Han fortæller også, at det landskab, golfklubben ligger i, er designet af en berømt britisk landskabsarkitekt, Capability Brown, som jeg har læst mig til, er krediteret som en af opfinderne af den højt besungne særlige engelske havestil tilbage i 1600-tallet. Så her må man selv sagt gå meget forsigtigt til værks. Og så lader vi båndet rulle videre i en 6 minutters tid, sådan I kan få en fornemmelse af, hvordan snakken flød frem og tilbage mellem de mange emner, jeg har nævnt.
My name is Johnny Perkins. I've been variously here at the All England Club for 24 tournaments. This is my 24th. I used to be the head of communications and now I look after the community relations here, so dealing with our neighbours, who we have obviously quite a number of houses in the area, and also local issues, I suppose, local politicians. So it's still an audience, but it's a different audience. Funny enough, it's less about the tournament and more about what we're doing here on site. So, for instance, as you know, this year we opened the new number one court in its new form with a new roof, and we've had a program of communications going out to the neighbors who live nearby, really telling them, here we're starting to build and we're going to make a lot of noise and we're going to make some dust, and it's things like that. So it's trying to bring them along. When we do planning applications, we have to consult with them, and a site of this size, I guess, same with the other tournaments as well. We're always slightly reinventing ourselves. Every year is different, and I think that's, in a way, some events you go to, and you, after 4 years, you think, well, I've sort of done this now. You know, they follow a pretty similar pattern. I've always thought, and here I am on my 24th, that the great thing about Wimbledon, and I'm sure it's the same with the other events as well, that it's no 2 years are the same. There are some similarities, and there's a lot of the, you know, when you're head of communications, a lot of the same problems or the same issues come around, and you think, yeah, we've done that one, we did this one, that's every year. But obviously the players change along the way, the cast, as it were, changes, but the grounds change, and they've been transformed. So we're sitting now in the Millennium Building. When I started, this wasn't here. This was number one court. So you get a feel for how it's sort of moved along. And so when you say, quite rightly, probably ask the question, what are you doing for all year? At any stage, we have 40 or so building projects along, obviously some bigger than others. But the big ones, certainly, we need to consult with our neighbours, and basically we want to be a good neighbour. Within, you know, we can't say to them, look, we're not going to do things, but we can do it in a responsible and neighbourly way. And in a way, we have to admit there would be some pain, but I think if we consult with them and we treat them properly, they get it.
I imagine that with the acquisition of the nearby golf course, this will take on a whole new dimension in the coming years.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Yeah, and you're absolutely right, because when you go, so part of my role is to go out to a lot of the meetings, and they're in the evenings, so they're all, you know, residents' associations meetings, and the two questions that, well, that's certainly one of the main questions, what are you going to do on the golf course? And at the moment, we're in a position of saying, well, broadly speaking, we know what we're doing in terms of We're going to bring the qualifying event here at some stage, but golf is being played there till 2021, and then maybe afterwards on a rolling basis. But in terms of our plans for that, that's as far as we've got. We now have a year at least to try and think about what we're going to do, where we're going to put these grass courts, how will we operate them, what the people around here know is that this golf course was designed by a very famous landscape designer called Capability Brown. Whether he did stuff in Denmark or not, I don't know, you never heard of him, no. But he's very famous in Britain, and this is one of his parks. We're sitting in a part of it now, and the golf course was another part of it before it became a golf course. And so there are trees there that he planted in 1760. They're 400 years old trees, so we can't go around cutting down trees, nor would we want to. So we want to work with the landscape, whatever we do will have to be sensitively done so as to enhance the landscape in a way and not ruin it. And obviously, our neighbours have a view on this land as well.
Just to go back to the reinvention bit for a while, for just a brief question. Coming here, this is my first tournament. What you are struck by is the attention to detail and also the heritage and the history. And there seems to be a special Wimbledon feel that never changes. And there must be a very, very particular balance between, you know, bringing something new to the experience, but also keeping lots of the things that, you know, makes Wimbledon stand out.
Make it what it is. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you're, in a way, if you feel that and it's your first visit, then that's good for us, because I guess that's one of the underlying principles here is that, it's a value of tradition, but equally it's not valuing it for tradition's sake. It's using it as a narrative to explain where we've come from for 134 years, as it were, in tournament terms, and using that as a central thread, because that links all the bits, and every year, so your first year is part of that now, part of that narrative. We've opened the roof on number one court. I was here when we did the 2009 when we opened the centre court roof. So it's always quite interesting when you look back as well, and you think when your colleagues are new, and for them it's, oh wow, you know, this is the great thing. Well, for us, some of us have seen it before, but I think what.
Jeg fortsætter med at spørge om, hvordan hele denne aura omkring Wimbledon bliver til og vedligeholdt set inden fra maskinrummet. Med andre ord forsøger jeg at indkredse præcis, hvad han mener, når han taler om Wimbledons fortælling, the narrative, som vi også var inde på i sidste afsnit. Denne snak om, hvordan klubben både forandrer og udvikler sig, samtidig med at bevare traditioner, der knytter an til turneringens lange historie. Hvem tager egentlig beslutningen om, hvad der skal bevares og hvad der ikke skal? Og som lovet i et tidligere afsnit, får jeg også anledning til at spørge, hvorfor Wimbledon ikke markerede Priden, når nu næsten alle andre i England gør det. Igen er lydklippet lidt længere for at give en fornemmelse af, hvordan en dygtig talsmand skræddersyr sine ord.
The narrative is the tradition is the spine, and then there are all these other bits that ebb and flow around it as we sort of move forward. And that, as I said, is the great beauty of the tournament. It's getting the detail right that gives you the bigger picture as well. And then long may it continue. The tradition is not tradition for tradition's sake. It's a basis for the narrative. It's our starting point, but when you look at Wimbledon, I think all the way along, there have been traditions, some of which we still have, and we guard them jealously, because that sets us apart from some of the other tournaments, and that's important, obviously, in the world we're in. But equally, there have been others along the way that have been, at some stage, decided, well, those actually don't fit with a more modern outlook, and so we've been fairly ruthless, I guess you would say, in that respect. Mm-hmm. So while sometimes the public perception is, oh well, they cling to outdated traditions, actually we don't. And by way of example, I suppose you could say, well, one of the ones we do cling to is that we still play on grass, the original game's original surface. There are various calls sometimes to, we should dig the grass up, it's an anachronism, outdated these days. But actually we see it the other way. And far from digging it up, we're busily helping re-establish, as it were, the grass court season. So Wimbledon does not stand alone, and that there are a decent level of tournaments and competition for the players, so that it is a proper circuit, mini circuit to be fair, but it's competitive. It offers decent prize money. It gives them players competition. They have time to adapt from clays to grass, and so these tournaments. There's a new one in Mallorca, and the ones we have in this country in Eastbourne and Birmingham and Nottingham, and we also that extends to juniors as well. So it's important that not only senior players have time to adapt, but the juniors too. And of course, one of the key reasons was why we moved the tournament. And arguably, you could say, well, the event had always been traditionally the seventh Monday after the beginning of June or whatever it was. But you know, if we're serious about this developing the grass court game, we need to give players another week. And that had been around I've been here long enough, I can remember when that was around in the early 2000s. But then, for whatever reason, the climate politically wasn't, and I say politically, but the small p in tennis, wasn't up for it, and possibly our broadcast contracts were different. So sometimes these things, you have to wait. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it was probably 15 years or so, but now we have a three-week gap, and actually what we're seeing here is now that the players are embracing that, and we don't want to go back to the days when clay court has said, well, you know, grass is for cows, you know, and sort of didn't come. So we've moved to meet game.
I'm curious if I can delve into that question for a little bit longer, Johnny. Who takes these decisions? Who makes these decisions? Is it a board, or is it, I mean, if it's slightly controversial as pushing the beginning of the tournament or introducing new colors, I don't know what, I mean, the things that sort of embody tournament, changing those things, I imagine, must be discussed at some board level, or who makes those decisions?
Well, you're absolutely right. So the way we're organized is that, as you, I'm sure your listeners are aware, so we have we are the All England Lawn Tennis Club. And so we're not the governing body of the game in this country. That's the Lawn Tennis Association, and presumably there's a Danish Tennis Association as well. And they're responsible for administering the game, growing the game, producing players. And our job, at least as a single focus, is to run the best championships we can. So we have a club board, or committee, board, but a more modern way of looking at it, which has 12 people on it, and they are drawn from the membership of the club. That takes us down the membership line, which we can come on to later, but broadly, basically, there are 500 members in the club, and so they will always try and choose people from, and pretty well, it's always from the club, and then there's the chairman of the club is chosen from the committee. So the committee of 12, and then you have a chairman who's one of the 12, whose job it is, therefore, to set the vision for where we go for the next short, medium, long term. And they're really the hand on the tiller in terms of keeping the ship on the right path. They meet, I think it's four times a year, but as you say, within that, where there are big decisions to make, and they've clearly got to allow themselves enough time to do it and to go out and discuss it with all the other elements of tennis. So obviously the ATP, the WTA, so the players are key in all of this, the ITF. So it's not a simple job. particularly something like that where you've got multi-agency, you need a multi-agency buy-in, really, from broadcasters and everyone else, and also, you know, people who've set their watches by Wimbledon for these for over a century, if they can, in terms of when it starts, and you suddenly say, well, actually, we're going to start a week later. There's a sort of, oh, hold on, I've always taken my holidays at this particular time, and of course we have 250 ball boys and ball girls who are school children. They're still in school, so you have to go and talk to the schools as well. So something like that has quite a long tail in terms of who you talk to. Some other ones are perhaps relatively more simple.
I have one question. I don't know if I'm allowed to ask it. I'll edit it out if it's too controversial.
Away. Oh, no, ask away.
I noticed that on the previous Saturday there was the Pride in London, and it was a big thing. It was much, much bigger than in Denmark. And, you know, they were flying rainbow colors all over the city and the corporate headquarters. It seemed to become a mainstream thing that the British society supports. I even heard one businessman say it has become more of a marketing strategy to be part of it than environment and climate issues. I don't know if that's true, but I just wondered, has there ever been a conversation in the club whether or not to mark this occasion? Is that too political or too...
I think the chances are there probably has, because I think that's the part of the essence of Wimbledon, of the brand, I guess, is that it extends way beyond tennis. You know, it is part of the social fabric. So I'm fairly sure at some stage someone will have had a conversation. But again, where you, I suppose, like every other organisation, where you align yourself and whether we need to do it, whether we should do it, is probably a conversation that's been had. And in this case, it was probably, well, look, that's not really what we do. You know, we do, for instance, acknowledge the Armed Forces Day here, although it used to be here when it was established, it was during the tournament, but now it's not. But we do acknowledge that one, and there's a simple reason, is that Armed Forces here have provided some of the stewards here since 1946. So I think where there's a bona fide connection, then there's obviously a better chance of people saying, yeah, well, I think we can that we can do, because it makes sense. It's part of our family. Where it's not, in a way, is, well, why, you know, what's the point of doing it in that respect? So we, you know, first and foremost, we're a tennis tournament. You know,
but you don't see any reason it couldn't happen in the future that you may or may.
I think probably not for me to second guess. What anyone would say, for instance.
Som I kunne høre, får han sagt, at muligheden for at markere priden formodentlig er blevet diskuteret i bestyrelsen. Men om og eventuelt hvordan, det var ikke hans rolle at gætte på, hvad der muligvis var blevet sagt til sådan et bestyrelsesmøde. Jeg spurgte også ind til, hvad Wimbledon gør med alle sine penge. For uanset alle de politisk korrekte ord, så er turneringen jo også en stor pengemaskine.
The Wimbledon is also a big commercial machine somehow. I mean, you see the sponsors and you know that a lot of money is being made. A lot of money is being paid out as well. Prize money is, I think, the largest in the tennis.
The prize money is the second
now.
The US is the largest. But I think
what do you do with all the money?
I
mean, you buy a golf course.
We buy a golf course for £65 million. I'm not a member, unfortunately. Failed to see that one. That's what we do. So remember, I talked about we've got the 40 odd building projects.
On the grounds?
Not necessarily. No, over. So you may not know, but over the road we have some indoor courts, and they are being knocked down. They're 50 years old. So in 1 month's time, we start knocking them down. And that's, again, a three-year building process. We've knocked them down. We're going to dig a big underground car park and then put new indoor courts on top, and then also put some clay courts over there, which are currently in the southern end of our grounds. So we don't just have grass here. We have clay, and we have indoor courts, so obviously people can play all year round. And the idea of moving the clay courts is that it opens up the southern end, where round about where court two is, and maybe at some stage there's an idea of having a bigger garden down there, and being able to put people have some of the queue down there, because at the moment we're quite limited on space. Mm. So that the feeling is if we can have somewhere to queue people down there, then we can make more of the seats on number two court open for our ground ticket holders. So don't forget we have a queue that comes in every day, could be 7,000 or 8,000, 9,000 strong depending on who's playing. They camp overnight, some of them. And that's about trying to get better value for those ticket holders, so that they can't, you know, because at the moment they can go on and you get a very good view. You're very close to the courts, and it's, again, we're back to one of our little traditions. People love queuing. If you took the queue away, it would probably be worse than Brexit. I don't know. It's a sort of, you know. So trying to sort of think, well, okay, if we did that, we could give them a chance to be on number two court, to a bit of value. But so we've got, you say, where do we spend the money? So we've got to spend it on that. Obviously, the golf course is to come. This building, the Millennium Building, is up for, it's 20 years old next year. So there's going to be some changes here.
So you invest in the tournament, in the club?
Invest in the facilities.
You don't buy real estate in New York or?
Not that I know of. No. We buy in SW19. No, you're absolutely right. So the money gets reinvested in the facilities. If you take the last, well, like my first tournament here was 1996. So the old number one court was still was old, and it was great. I mean, it was old, yes. And when the centre and number one emptied at the same time, very, very congested. And these days, health and safety, people don't like that. So I started essentially with the building of the new number one court, the hill, then the big screen. All that was new then. You know, someone came up with the idea of, let's have a hill. I mean, what a great idea that was. Who was that? Where is it? Is it in the minutes that someone said we must have a hill? So tunnels underneath as well. That's one of the try and get all the services moving underground. Remember the chairman at the time saying, well, it's sort of, you know, taking some inspiration from Disneyland, where they do try and keep all the towel, everything else, you know, as much of as possible, so that it's not in the way of the spectators' enjoyment. They're not having being towels coming past them or things. So that sort of, when we started, we were talking about the level of detail, and I said there was a list, so the list might have 1,000 things on it. Some are, we can do next year, tweaks here, a bit of better signage. We're much better now at asking people. I think in the past we sort of assumed we knew what people wanted, whereas now we're much more about saying to people, how was your experience today? You as a member of the media, how did you find it? Mm. Do you get access? Is your food okay? Is your working conditions right? And it's the same throughout. Mm. Are the players happy when they said they wanted, we need more warm-up space? We built a warm-up, we dug underneath, and we built them a warm-up space. But to do that, we had to dig up courts 14 and 15, huge, great holes, and then we moved the ball boys and ball girls out of their space, because they were underground, but gave them a brand new area with table tennis tables and more space and light. We moved 350 photographers out of where we're sitting now. This room used to be the camera shop, servicing shop. They all went underground. They're under 14, the ball boys are under 15. New media restaurant. And then that gave us the space to create the new warm-up zone underground for the players, and the sort of gym equipment in it and things. So it's always always moving, you know.
Nu sagde Johnny Perkins, at Wimbledon også bare er en helt almindelig tennisklub. Når turneringen er forbi, foregår helt almindelige klubting. Og selvom man forsøger at differentiere mellem klub og turnering, ja, så synes jeg ikke altid, det lykkedes. Det var for eksempel klubben, der udsendte den pressemeddelelse, som jeg synes meget godt afspejler, hvilket luftlag vi befinder os i. Den nævnte pressemeddelelse landede i min inbox 14. juli, altså på finaledagen. Her beklager klubben sig over, at ukendte aktører i Saudi-Arabien har distribueret fjernsynsdækning af turneringen uden at have købt licens. Og det kan man jo godt forstå er et problem. Som Johnny Perkins sagde, er tv-rettighederne den mest indbringende del af hele forretningen omkring Wimbledon. Men det er på den anden side ikke en hvilken som helst klub, der i sin pressemeddelelse kan opfordre Udenrigsministeriet til at gøre noget ved sagen, og samme aften faktisk se Udenrigsministeriet følge op på problemet. Der er med andre ord en kort kommandovej fra tennisklubben og ind i de højeste politiske cirkler i Westminster. Jeg talte også med Johnny Perkins om klubbens bæredygtighedsambitioner. Han talte mest om de lange forsyningskæder, en turnering som Wimbledon har, så lange, at man flere år i forvejen må forudse, hvilke små eller store tiltag, man kan implementere lidt længere ned ad vejen. Man kunne ikke bare fra det ene år til det andet indføre bionedbrydelige sugerør, som Wimbledon nu har gjort det. Det var en beslutning, der blev taget for 5 år siden. En interessant detalje om det med at være bæredygtig, som de færreste, der elsker både sport og klimaet, måske tænker over, er værd at nævne her. Det var faktisk ikke Perkins, der fortalte mig det, men den bedste britiske kvindelige spiller, Joanna Konta, som gjorde opmærksom på den altid tilstedeværende angst, spillerne havde for at indtage noget, mad eller drikke, de ikke var 100% sikre på, var fri for alle de stoffer, der står på dopinglisten. Med andre ord, angsten for at indtage noget, man ikke ønsker at indtage, fordrede, at spillerne kun indtog mad og drikke, der kom i forseglede emballager. Det var ifølge Konta svært at se, hvordan man kunne mindske plastikforbruget i den sammenhæng. Til sidst, det er måske allervigtigste. Hvordan kommer man selv til Wimbledon? Hvordan får man fingre i en billet?
So the way we sell our tickets has been through this public ballot since 1924. That ballot is open to everyone. You have to be a bit organized in terms of you have to submit your application before, I think it's the end of December. But apart from that, anyone throughout the world can apply. I mean, we do have an overseas ballot as well. So in fact, there's a home ballot, overseas ballot, and that is a lottery.
It's
a lottery. So you apply, you're lucky.
So anybody can win. You don't
Euro
need
millions.
To
it's exactly the
live
same.
In a mansion.
Yeah, you don't know, absolutely not. No. So they've always been.
How many tickets are put in the public?
I can't tell you, we don't have exact figures, but it's sort of.
Is it half of all? Or
more than half.
More than half.
Yeah, more than half. And then another big percentage go to tennis clubs, as you might expect. People who play tennis. That's one of the, you know, they are the ultimate true fan. They play tennis, and so they should be. They have a separate ballot, as well. Then you have there is a small about 8% is for the corporate market, and we have also a number called debentures, which very briefly are the ways of they guarantee you a seat for 5 years on either centre or number one. You pay more for it, but you're guaranteed the seat, and that's the money that we use basically to rebuild. So the roof on number one court, the roof on centre, multi-million pound projects funded by debentures. And then, of
just
course...
Just to get that straight, Johnny, the debentures are essentially rich people who can afford to pay a lot of money for tickets that guarantee them a seat on centre court and number one court.
Correct.
And those money make up the bulk of the kind of budget you have for am I exaggerating?
Yes, you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what the percentage is that? Is that 5 or 2% of the
I don't know what the percentage is, but it's let's say it's £100 million from the most recent issue. So that we don't get public money. It's a self-funding private event. So obviously we have our biggest income is from broadcast. But that goes into the sinking pot usually of running, paying for the tournament, really. Any money after we paid for it that's left goes to the Lawn Tennis Association. That's through an agreement we've had with them for a long time. That's about £38-40 million. And then the money, as you say, from the debentures is ring-fenced, and that's the pot that pays for all the developments. Yeah. No government money. Some other events get government money or local things. So, but I think that the key point about it is that we've always felt there's an entry point for anyone who wants to come. There is a way of doing it. If you want to buy a debenture and you've got the money, terrific. That helps us. That means we know where we are with some certainty. The main tickets in the ballot are benchmarked against other sporting events of similar caliber. And if in the first week you can come, don't forget you're not coming for one match. There's always that slight thing of, oh, I'm coming to the men's finals. Well, you're not. That is one match, and there are three others on centre court that day. So you're buying for the day. And obviously, you know, if you people quote the end, tend to quote the finals tickets and say, well, it's very expensive. But say, well, yeah, it would be, because it's against these other. If you went to the Formula One Grand Prix, if you went to the World Cup cricket tomorrow, you know, you wouldn't be paying. You'd be paying a fair amount. You look at first week in Wimbledon, it's £50-60 for a whole day. So I mean, if you know, probably doesn't even equate to a concert ticket, which is probably way up there as well.
Altså, for at gøre det lidt kort, man køber et lod i et lotteri om at få lov til at købe en billet. Der er forskellige lotterier, alt efter om man er englænder eller ej, om man er medlem af en tennisklub eller ej. Her bliver lige over halvdelen af alle billetter solgt, og alt efter hvad du vil se og hvornår du vil se det, så koster en dagsbillet ca. 600 kroner. For den sum får du så adgang til 12 timers Wimbledon-oplevelse. Og så er der alle dem med privilegier, altså sponsorerne og klubbens medlemmer og venner og alle spillernes familiemedlemmer og tennisverdens penger og selvfølgelig de super rige, der har muligheden for at købe særlige femårskort. Det Johnny Perkins her benævner The Bendiches. De giver adgang til faste VIP-pladser til alle de kampe, man måtte ønske i den periode, kortet gælder. Perioden udløb sidste år, og i starten af 2019 blev de nye femårskort sat til salg. Og som man kunne læse i The Guardian her i foråret, er efterspørgslen langt større end udbuddet. Og dem, der er så heldige i at få fingre i et af de her femårskort, kan angiveligt sælge dem videre for i omegnen af 50 millioner kroner. The Bendiches, altså de super rige, udgør omkring 0,1% af billetterne, der er til salg, men de smider omkring 1 milliard kroner i Wimbledons kasse. Og så er der køen, den berømte Wimbledon-kø. Ja, faktisk er der to køer. Den ene udgøres af dem, der ligger i teltkø natten over i parken over for stadion, for at få lov til at købe nogle af de dagsbilletter, der hver morgen sælges ved indgangen. Denne lidt festivalagtige oplevelse er ifølge Johnny Perkins så populær blandt mange Wimbledon-fans, at selvom det er et pokkers besvær med logistik og toiletforhold til de dagligt ca. 3.000 kamperende, der ligger over i parken og venter på deres tur, ja, så ville det udløse et større oprør end Brexit, hvis man fjernede den kø, spørger han. Den anden kø er lidt mindre, men stadig imponerende og udgøres af dem, der kommer for at købe en billet af dem, der allerede har fået nok tennis for i dag og går hjem, før dagens program er forbi. Omtrent 400-500 mennesker står dagligt i kø for at købe en brugt billet. Ja, jeg så til min forbløffelse, at selv sent om aftenen ved 21-tiden stod der stadig omkring 100 mennesker, der åbenbart var villige til at betale de ca. 200 kroner, det kostede, bare at komme ind på stadion. Vi linker til lotteriet på hjemmesiden, og der er altså flere muligheder for at komme ind, hvis man ikke vinder der, og så dyrt er det jo altså heller ikke. Ellers kan man jo altid forsøge at blive akkrediteret som journalist. Det kan godt anbefales. Tak fordi I lyttede med på disse indslag om Wimbledon. Håber I synes, det har været interessant. Og hvem ved, om vi vender tilbage til næste år og beretter om, hvordan man holder duerne væk. Jeg kan afsløre, at han hedder Rufus. Good.
I hørte Rasmus Blædel Larsen og Johnny Perkins, og vi linker til klubbens hjemmesides beskrivelse af, hvordan man køber billetter.